This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Well, if you were watching the news this week, you probably didn't know that the Federal Reserve testified twice before Congress. Well, the only ones listening seem to be the markets. And we saw stock prices pull back from some of the gains earlier in the week. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. Coming up in Hour 1, Craig Johnson will be joining me. He's a little bit concerned, and we'll be talking about this later on in the big picture, about, as he calls it, 2 feet driving the car. One's on the gas pedal and one's on the brake. And he's talking about the conflict between fiscal and monetary policy. He's also talking about, even though the markets are up, a lot of those gains in the S&P 500 have come from a handful of stocks, the FANG stocks and Microsoft. Small cap stocks are looking a little bit better in small cap growth. And he's also talking about some breakdowns of some key overseas indexes. Craig is bullish energy right now. You're going to want to hear what he has to say about that and what he also has to say about sectors that are breaking down that should be an early warning sign. Also, Rob Bernard will be joining me later on in the program as we look at interest rates around the globe. Returns on municipal bonds, which have been stellar. We'll also be talking about ways to earn 5% and 6% in corporate bonds, and also a flattening yield curve, a different perspective. And of course, Ryan Poplava will be here as well to talk about what moved the markets. All of that coming up in Hour 1.
And I'm John Loeffler. What would happen, just imagine, if the Federal Reserve testified before Congress and nobody seemed to care? Well, that's what happened this week. You know, usually when a Fed chair testifies, it's front page news, but the media were obsessively occupied over not really the Trump-Putin summit, but rather the press conference following the Trump-Putin summit. They seemed to talk of nothing else. And what the Fed said, or having corporate earnings looking pretty good, was largely ignored. So what does all of that mean? Not about the media, but the fact that the Fed is saying they don't see any threats on the horizon and all systems seem to be go for raising rates more. That's the first part of the big picture today. The second part is similar because it seems to be the competition has begun. President Trump versus the Fed. The president recognizing that while the government is trying to raise stimulus, the Fed is actually raising rates, which usually puts a damper on that. That combined with the rise in oil prices. So all of that coming up today on the big picture as part of the Financial Sense News Hour. And as we do in the first part of the program, Ryan Poplava is welcomed back to the show as we discuss the events in finance. And of course, what we do is a wrap up of the week for our listeners. So, Ryan, is I guess the question that I always start with, can you talk about the drivel and cattle that, I'm sorry, drivers and catalysts that move the market?
The drivel and cattle. Yeah, John, I'd summarize that we have strong earnings, and that's on the table. We all know that. But there hasn't been much of a response once those earnings have come out. I mean, individually, for individual companies, we're seeing that. Last week, we start off with the financials on Friday. We kicked off again with financials on Monday with Bank of America, and they were able to beat earnings, and there was a much better response to those earnings. The market rallied. Financials were up quite a bit. And then Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley further into the week, same thing, great results. And that ended up with the financials having the best sector performance this week, and that was earnings driven, so that was a good thing. When we look at the market, it is sort of advanced in anticipation of earnings being strong. If you look at since the 4th of July week, we've seen a rally ahead of earnings. Earnings are now here. Now it's what's next? Or are we going to get that same kind of response that we saw in the first quarter to Caterpillar's response to their margins possibly peaking in the first quarter? They said that it was likely the best we'll see all year, even though they continue to ramp up projections for earnings throughout the rest of the year. So that's it. Are we looking at a case of this is as good as it gets, or are we going to hear some new news? So we all knew going into this that earnings were going to be good. They were up 19% estimated, and I think they're supposed to be around up 21% in the third quarter, and then somewhere around there also in the fourth quarter. So again, how's the reaction? We were mainly flat this week. So moving on, earnings was the big deal. We're going to continue to get a lot of earnings. I think there were 65 companies that announced this week. We're going to get a heck of a lot more next week. And of course, it wouldn't be a week in the market if there wasn't some sort of news, new information on trade between the U.S. and its partners. And President Trump told CNBC in an interview that he is ready to impose tariffs on all imports from China, which would essentially affect around $505 billion in trade. And as I mentioned on the show, there were rumors of this. There was, I think, a Reuters article 2 weeks ago about what Trump had said to some reporters on Air Force One. And so that was just kind of maybe hearsay, wasn't direct. This was in our face. This was on CNBC, right in front of us. There it is. And of course, we had that announcement last week of the tariffs on $200 billion in goods. And so we saw that he's actually making good on that rumor. And so, again, he says he stands ready. He's not really satisfied with the responses he's seen so far from China. Larry Kudlow came out early in the week stating that some of the lower officials in China are ready to do more, but kind of getting rebuffed by President Xi. And they, of course, responded that that's just bogus. So it's just going back and forth per usual.
Yeah, yeah. And it seems, too, that since we're talking about China there, it seems that the curtain has gone up on Act 2 of the trade wars, to broaden this out a bit, with what appears the digging in of heels on both sides. But that's typical. I mean, this is normal in this type of a situation. Now, the other area you mentioned in the past is the declining yuan, as well as strains on other countries with currencies that are pegged to the dollar and or carrying dollar-denominated debt that only gets more expensive as the dollar strengthens. Did you see that President Trump had some comments about the Fed this week and the dollar, and now he was talking about it?
Yeah, that was also part of that interview. And those effects actually had an influence on trading directly. We were watching the dollar, my brother and I, on Thursday, and saw a direct spike down in the dollar as a result of that. And here's what he said in the interview. He's not thrilled the Fed is raising borrowing costs and potentially slowing the economy, which caused, like I said, the dollar to just spike lower, because in a sense, he's saying the Fed needs to be a little more dovish. And the reason why we have such a strong dollar, many reasons. We have a strong economy. We have a strong market. We have interest rate differentials that are a lot higher here than they are abroad. In fact, I think the 3-month T-bill is yielding more than, I think, the 30-year on around 12 different sovereign countries in Europe. So just to give you an idea, why else would somebody want to take money out of the dollars and invest somewhere else with lower yield? So anyways, that's what's driving the dollar. But essentially, a strong Fed is part of that equation. So these were rather controversial comments, because presidents have refrained from comments to protect the Fed's independence. And here we are on Friday, the White House issued a statement that the president respects the independence of the Fed with no plans interfering with Fed decisions. So that was good. I looked at the Fed fund futures. We saw this big dip in the dollar. What about the Fed fund futures? Is the market still looking at an outlook of its third hike in September? And that is the case. The Fed funds futures are pricing in a third hike in September with an 87% chance. There were some more comments all week from Fed officials, including Chairman Powell. He was speaking before Congress. And the only language that was changed from what we saw in the June policy statement is he added "for now." So here's what it was. The FOMC believes that for now, the best way forward is to keep gradually raising the Fed funds rate, which in my opinion, John, leaves it still wide open. They can either increase it faster, they can slow it down depending on maybe signs of overheating versus slower growth as it's part of maybe some of the trade concerns. He reiterated that there is a rising chorus of concerns over trade tensions. And regarding the flat yield curve, what really matters, he said, is where the neutral rate is. Of course, that topic I've talked about a little bit. It's quite debatable, and it's been debated, I would call it, off balance sheet by some of the Fed governors in their own white papers, etc., about what that really is. And but there's just been nothing really official from the Fed statements. And John, if I could continue on the Fed and maybe kind of segue into economics. The Fed's Beige Book was released this week, and that's a report looking at all the 12 different districts of the Fed, what's activity look like there. It's kind of a leading indicator. And they said about 10 of the 12 districts had moderate to modest growth, with Dallas strong due to higher energy prices, energy obviously being a very big industry in Texas. But the key here is that on trade, manufacturers in all districts expressed concerns about tariffs, and in many districts reported higher prices and supply disruptions, and as well as a number reporting higher input costs due to the import tariffs, rising prices. So if you read between the lines, John, the unintended consequences, something I've brought up many times here, of tariffs is raising prices on goods. And that may end up being the very driver of inflation that causes the Fed to have to raise rates even more aggressively to combat inflation. So of course, the end of the business cycle where labor is tight as well as resources is the primary source of inflation. But clearly from these reports here, the tariffs are causing input prices to go up and supply disruptions. Trump just might not like rates going up, but the tariffs will likely be reinforcing that trajectory.
Yeah, you can see that. Now, let me drag this back to China because we really didn't finish everything there. You know, we've seen that the Chinese are really digging in their heels right now, maybe, let's say, by not defending their currency, even though they said recently they were going to. What are some of the other effects this might be causing in the market?
Well, as Chris was adamantly putting it to me earlier this week, the Chinese will be exporting more than goods, John. They're going to be exporting deflation, sending out their goods at a lot lower prices. So take a look at commodity prices. I think that reflects some of that concern. Copper is down 17% since June. Gold is down 10%. I think also silver since June. Gold since April. So real quickly, John, answering this question, I have noted that a short-term bounce, we've seen this in the Asian equities over the past week, as well as conditions that seem kind of oversold to me in commodities, including that for gold and silver. So we've seen this big correction in commodities. I've dipped my toe in a little bit in gold this week personally. And despite I know that some technicians I've read have said to really stay away from it, it's broken down. And I agree with that. You know, we had a nice trend from 2016. That trend has been broken. And so now we've got to see the establishment of maybe a new trend, but the intermediate trend since April has been down. But, you know, I think it might be overdone. So I'm taking my toe in, seeing what happens. I'm more of a snap trader, John, than maybe a trend follower. But, you know, China, they are definitely not defending their currency. Huge drop in that. That is, as I've expressed many times over the past, I would say, 3 weeks watching this, that gets to be a huge concern for currencies pegged to the dollar. Looking at other EM currencies with a strong dollar, a lot of trade issues, it's being reflected there. And it could give rise to, I think BCA was talking about this in a recent note this week, it could give rise to a major currency crisis situation, they said, greater than the one we saw in 1997 between the different Asian currencies.
Yeah, and we'll have to follow up on that, by the way, and ask Craig Johnson coming up shortly about his outlook for commodities given recent events. All right, my famous question, was there anything else we need to talk about the economics of the week or earnings which we might not have thought of?
The infamous what else? On the economic side, we got retail sales, which were probably one of the more important data points this week. That was up about 0.5% month over month in June, as expected. There was also, I think Amazon had its Amazon Day. I forget how long that lasted, if it was 36 hours or whatnot, but whatever the period was, they said it was the greatest sales period that they've ever experienced. So that's phenomenal. Anecdotal, of course, about what's going on in the retail sector, but when Amazon talks, a lot of ears listen. So that's one of the strongest areas of the economy. It's been retail recently. That's 70% of our GDP. Obviously, we got to be focusing on that. The IMF gave its global outlook this week, kind of forecasting no change with expectations of around 3.9% growth. But they did state a number of things that were concerning, that the expansion is becoming less even and risks are mounting, stating that the rate of expansion appears to have peaked in some major economies and growth has become less synchronized. So lowering their forecast for Europe, interestingly enough, down to 2.2% in 2018, down to 1.9% next year, probably factoring in the whole Brexit situation in March. And then saying trade is the greatest near-term threat. So I guess that affirms why we talk about it, John, every week.
Yeah.
Week in and week out, trade, trade, trade. So industrial production was up 0.6% versus 0.5% expected. That was good. In earnings, so again, we had 64 companies this week in the S&P announcing didn't seem to have an overall effect on the market. A select few sectors, again, financials, did really well. Netflix dropped a lot on a miss in subscriber growth. I forget if it was intraday around down 14%. I forget exactly where it closed, but I know it was single digits. Was able to mostly recover, so not bad, given it's more than 100% gain this year. And it's part of that, the whole FANG complex, the Facebook, Apple, Netflix, Google, Alphabet, rather. So Bank of America, Goldman, Morgan Stanley, all topped. Again, that helped the financials. The financials were clearly the best sector this week. Next week will be a very big week in earnings as the bulk of the season really kicks off, John. And at that point, I'll talk about some numbers maybe about how things look overall. We had some estimates going in, but now it's time to look at essentially the report card. So year-to-date, the S&P 500 is up 4.8%. The NASDAQ is up 13.3%. The Russell 2K is up 10.5%. And the Dow, only 1.4, hit the hardest by trade fears given the large number of multinationals there.
All right, Ryan Poplavin, you're on vacation next week, so you won't be here, but I appreciate it, and I'm assuming you'll be back safe and sound the week after that. So appreciate your time, and I say it every week, it's really interesting now. It's not just dull watching the interaction between politics and economics as they go on. So things are going to stay interesting here for the next few years.
Yeah, clearly. It started off last year with taxes, relooking at healthcare, possibly deregulation. We've had some deregulation this year, but not, I think, to the extent that he wants. So yeah, definitely fiscal policy is part of Wall Street right now and something we got to continue to focus on.
Yep, exactly. All right, Ryan Poplava, see you back.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at FinancialSense.com. To speak to Jim Poplava or his financial planning team, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized investment portfolio.
You know, Financial Sense News Hour listeners should remember that our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense News Hour featuring interviews with top economic commentators and experts. If you're not a member, here's one of the interviews you missed this week.
Global growth is peaking. We have the slowdown in China, and early indicators are also pointing to a slowdown in U.S. manufacturing. U.S. manufacturing has been very strong, but the indicators for U.S. manufacturing, which give a good three-month lead, are pointing to lower manufacturing. These pose enormous headwinds for global cyclical sectors, so U.S., but also global cyclical sectors. For instance, if you look at the earnings of the energy stock, industrial stock, or tech stock, these are also have very good relationships with things like our China leading indicator and with some of our global lead indicators too. So we expect to see the earnings of cyclical stock are going to struggle, and therefore we expect stock prices are going to face headwinds as well, that slowdown begins to manifest.
Well, here we are on Friday, struggling to stay into positive territory. We've got the Dow going back and forth. It's been that way since the opening bell. Some bad earnings coming from General Electric. And the stock market is still struggling to stay in positive territory for the year. Joining me on the program is Craig Johnson from Piper Jaffray. Craig, last time we had you on the program, you were somewhat cautious for the market for the first part of the year. And that has turned out to be a good call, given, you know, we basically go back and forth from being positive back to negative, and here we are giving back some of the gains this week. What's your view now? Do you still hold that?
Well, first and foremost, thank you for having me back on the show, and I really appreciate coming back to talk to everybody. So, Jim, where we're at, we have not changed our 2850 year-end price objective on the S&P 500. I know that's what the listeners, you know, are wanting to listen for in here, so I'll throw that right up front. Where we're struggling with this market here is, it to us is like driving a car with one foot on the gas and one foot on the brake when you think about the monetary policy right now happening. We've got the White House wanting to pour on more economic stimulus through tax cuts and other items like that. And then we also have the Federal Reserve continuing on a path of gradually raising interest rates. So it feels like, well, honestly, my father, he always drives his car with 2 feet. And so you're on the gas, you're on the brake, you're on the gas, and it makes for kind of a jerky ride. And that's exactly what you're seeing happening in the overall market at this point. So from my perspective, Jim, I think we're probably going to get more of the same, and we're going to get more of this kind of sideways consolidation and chop. So I haven't changed my 2850 objective at this point in time. And last weekend, I updated my bottoms-up model for the market, and I came up with a number of 2826 spot 55. So I feel like we're pretty much on the mark with our 2850 number right now.
You know, Craig, at least in throughout my career, and maybe you might want to comment on yours, I've never seen what we're seeing today with this 1 foot on the pedal, 1 foot on the brake. Normally, if you go back to, for example, the beginning of the Obama administration, you had fiscal stimulus coming from the White House and you had monetary stimulus coming from the Fed. Same thing, if you go back to the Bush administration, they usually work in conjunction with each other, not as opposing forces as they're doing now. I've never seen this before, and it's kind of hard to, you know, figure out where this is going to end up. But we do know that if they keep raising rates, sooner or later, they're going to break something.
Jim, I would agree with that. And when you go back and you look at history and you look at inversions of yield curves, as we get closer to zero, the probabilities of a recession rise. And that's been a very good indicator, the inversion of the yield curve. I think it's been 100% accurate going back in time to predicting recessions. So this kind of push and pull is going to create some strain. And I agree with you, something's going to break. We're not sure really what it is at this point in time. And at the same point in time, you've got changing and a more tense geopolitical setup starting to happen around the world with more discussions of tariffs and those kind of things.
You know, for our listeners, and there's been a lot of money over the last couple of years, Craig, that has gone into index funds. If you look at the S&P, it's up a little over 4%. That looks pretty good. But let's talk about what's driving it. If you look at where the returns have come in the S&P, it's basically the FANG stocks plus Microsoft. Let's talk about that for a moment, because underneath the hood, things don't look as good.
Yeah, you know, Jim, when we look under the hood as a technician, we call this the overall breadth of the market. And what we've been seeing with our work, and markets have been pushing ahead, but the participation hasn't been quite as strong as we would like. It has not been weak enough, though, on the other hand, to trigger our 26-week new highs indicator and push that into a sell position. It hasn't pushed our 40-week technique where we look at the number of stocks above a 40-week moving average into a sell position either. So we're kind of just sort of muddling along. And when you look at the FANG stocks and the participation, Jim, I think the actual first half, I think it's more than half, if not slightly more than that, of the performance has come from the FANG stocks. And this is something that I've been talking about since the beginning of the year, that there's been a fairly high concentration of performance in the market. In January, we were talking about Boeing and Caterpillar and 3M and some of these names all being parabolic looking charts that ultimately needed to correct, and they have corrected. And I continue to look at the FANG stocks. Nothing seems to be slowing them down at this juncture. Even a 15% sell-off in Netflix quickly was bought, or perhaps it was short covering. Not sure which yet, but those stocks continue to hold up, and that's where everybody's viewing the growth at this point in time, Jim. So it concerns me how concentrated it has become, for sure.
I wonder, Craig, how much of this has to do with indexing. I mean, if I'm, you know, Vanguard or Fidelity or BlackRock and I'm running an index fund, I get $100 million of money or $1 billion of new money in an index fund. Well, you know exactly where it's going. It's going in those FANG stocks that make up a good percentage weight of the index. So, you know, indexing is playing a role here. I want to move on to some of the smaller stock indexes. You take a look at the Russell, and let's talk about the NASDAQ. Once again, very heavily weighted towards those kind of stocks, like even a Microsoft.
So, Jim, let me add one thing about ETFs in here real quick, too, is there's actually more ETFs than there are individual stocks in the market today. So if we're talking about something being out of skew, I struggle with the notion that we've got more ETFs than individual stocks. I would not have imagined that would have been the case. And ultimately, I've always said that if we're going to get a problem in the future, it may surround ETFs at some point in time. I get the low-cost advantage for the ETFs for a lot of people and single-point decisions to own sectors and those kind of things. But you start tearing into some of these ETFs, you got a high concentration in a handful of stocks, especially when you start looking inside of the XL, the technology index itself, too. Now, in terms of small cap versus large cap, I'll add growth versus value in there too, Jim. And right now for me, it's more about small cap, mid cap growth. Value is not working at this point in time. The momentum stocks continue to push ahead and make new highs. And that's where a lot of the concentration is at right now. And when I look at small cap funds and talk to individuals that are involved in the small cap world, it feels like to me, in kind of summarizing some of their thoughts and pulling it together, it's like money has come out of large cap, it's gone into the small cap world, and now you're seeing these small cap stocks, quote unquote, dragged higher by the amount of money that's coming into the small cap land at this point in time. And clearly, just a little bit of money coming out of the FANG stocks can push up small mid-cap indexes pretty appreciably. And I think to a degree, that's what's happening at this point in time. And I know that a lot of people will call this sticking close to home and avoiding the tariffs and those kind of things. But I think this is more or less just a flow issue with a lot of illiquid areas inside the market.
Let's move on from not only our markets, but what about markets overseas, especially as you see some problems in emerging markets, whether you're looking at debt or even looking at the equities. Let's talk about Asia for a moment.
Sure. So, Jim, when we start looking around at all the exchanges all around the world, what I would first point out is as I look around all these, you know, world markets and just looking at, you know, the year-to-date returns, you know, the U.S. continues to stand out as among the strongest indexes or the strongest markets around the world. You look around at China, you look around at the FTSE, you look around at the Euro Stock 50, we're all performing. Now, specifically, Jim, I'd come back and point out is the Shanghai. So the Shanghai composite has been off upwards of 25%. You're still off 20% from the highs. You're in a bear market at this point in time. But more important, as an individual who looks at charts, I would point out that we are literally sitting right now on top of the uptrend support line on the Shanghai composite going back to 1996. So from my perspective, we're at a very crucial juncture on this chart, and a failure to hold that level would suggest that the next big area of support for the Shanghai would come in just below 2,000. And right now, the Shanghai composite trades at about 28, 29. So that'd be a meaningful move lower from here. And does this all probably relate back to trade and tariff issues and things like that? The answer is probably yes. But if you're going to see that kind of sell-off in the Shanghai composite on a break below that uptrend support line, what I would say is I don't think the rest of the world is going to be immune. And that clearly would be the United States too.
I want to move on to something that you brought up earlier, and this relates to this two pedals driving the car, one on the gas, one on the brake. Let's talk about the yield curve, because there's, what, almost less than 25 basis points between the 2 and the 10. And I know the Fed this week was asked that in its congressional testimony, and it was sort of dismissed that, well, it really doesn't apply. Craig, as far back as I know, this has been a fairly accurate indicator in terms of future recessions. So let's talk about, we've got, what, 86% probability. They raise rates again in September, over 50% probability. They raise in December. Is this a, you know, like the movie A Bridge Too Far, is this going to be two rate hikes too far?
Yeah, Jim. So as I look at the shape of the yield curve, think about the historical meaning of this. Two things that I would bring up. First, as far as I have looked back in time and spent quite a distance in time, I have not seen this indicator fail. It's worked 100% of the time, as far as I can look back. Maybe people can look past 1900, but from where I can see, it's been a very solid tool. The second part of this is that as we get closer to 5 to 10 basis points, even our economist here at Piper Jaffray has denoted that the risks of a recession rise pretty quickly in his models as you start moving into the 2 to 10 basis point range. So the odds of a recession, I think, are rising. So that headwind is going to be there. Now, as I think about this push and pull between the Fed and everything else, part of the challenge that some people will say it's different this time is, well, the long end is really being held down by a lot of international buyers of our debt, continuing to say the U.S. is the safest debt to go buy, and they continue to buy it, that's holding down the long end. So people are envisioning some sort of scenario where you're going to get this expansion in growth, but yet interest rates aren't going to go up, and somehow we're going to have this kind of growth that is not going to be leading to the traditional inflation metrics. I'm not sure that I can completely agree with that, Jim, at this point in time. You know, I'm going to stick with what history has ultimately said. And this flattening of the yield curve for me is a meaningful hurdle that we're going to have to continue to face.
Powell's a little bit different. He's not an academic like previous Fed chairman. Craig, you know, they've been doing this for a long time. They know every time they get in this rate-raising cycle, 11 out of the last 12 recessions since World War II were preceded by a rate-raising cycle. What is it about the Fed that they can't see that eventually they keep doing this, they're going to crash the economy? It's kind of like that episode from The Office where they're asking somebody, one guy who's saying, well, I raised my cholesterol, and they say, why would you want to do that? So I can prove I can lower it again. So, I mean, do these guys ever learn?
Well, I mean, I have all the respect for the Fed and the Fed officials for the work that they're doing, but I think where they're at is there is not a lot of arrows left in the quiver. So if there is to be a recession around the corner, they want to be able to reduce rates to try to create some stimulus, you know, in the future and be able to have that as a mechanism for monetary policy once again. But it's an interesting way of going about it, and I think that they'd be better off just simply letting inflation run and get a little hotter. And, you know, Jim, your statements earlier were correct, that they are looking for right now an 80%+ probability of a rate hike in September. And as you move through the December, it's also in the 80% range too. So we're at this point in time where it looks like the next two rate increases are probably likely locked in from the market at this point in time.
Yeah, you know, that can't be good news. I mean, the Fed has to be aware. I mean, when you have people, a lot of strategists, people, even the economists in your own organization, you start looking at that yield curve inversion, and it really sends a strong signal. Look out ahead. Let's move to the energy side. We've got West Texas Intermediate crude here, almost at $70 on this Friday. We've got Brent at $73. What about the energy sector in commodities? And then I want to touch upon gold.
Yeah. So, Jim, we are overweight energy at this point in time with our work. We continue to believe that the little setback you've had in oil prices over the last couple of weeks is really temporary. It's just kind of a correction within an uptrend. I keep hearing from our fundamental analysts here at Piper Jaffray that, you know, the environment is tightening, and it's among the most attractive environments and setups that they've seen in quite some time. Quoting one of our senior analysts. And from my perspective, I don't think, from what I'm seeing and hearing from them, there's not a lot of spare capacity out there. So if the economy is going to be moving up and as strong as we're talking about, the consumption of oil is going to be going up, and I don't think there's going to be enough spare capacity. So I'd look for oil prices to remain firm and maybe even firm up even further from where we are right now. So, Jim, some of the names that look interesting for us are things like Oasis, some of the things like Range Resources, WPX are things that we've liked in the energy area. Now, switching gears and thinking about gold. Gold, from our perspective, even though we've got these headwinds out here on the macro side that we've talked about, the one thing that I haven't seen so far is I haven't seen any fear. I haven't seen gold prices working their way higher. In fact, gold failed about four times to get through 1360, and now it looks like perhaps we're going to be starting a new leg lower here in gold. I think there's support around 1200, 1210, somewhere in that kind of range for gold, but it's definitely not catching a bid right now, and it's not suggesting that there's a lot of fear among investors right now. You know, moving on to some of the other commodities, if we want to touch on corn and other things, there's been a lot of dislocation in the corn market, the bean market, over the last several months in here with the trade tariffs and purely the large number of soybeans that are purchased, you know, out of the Midwest going to China. And that's been a meaningful sell-off in that area. But I heard from some pretty smart people in that space, and perhaps we're getting to a point in time where beans and corn might be getting close to have bottomed out over the short to intermediate term, Jim.
Let's talk about another commodity they call Dr. Copper. Copper seems like it's rolling over. What does that signify to you? It looks to me like growth is slowing down globally, although the IMF just put out and they expect international growth to hit 3.9 this year. I think that might be a little bit optimistic from what I'm seeing. But what about copper?
So one of the big uses for copper on a regular basis is to go into the housing market. And when you come back and you start looking at the housing market, the permits have been decent. but the housing starts have been a little slower than expected. And the challenge that you're running into is a lot of these housing plays like Lennar and Horton and others, they're finding it a very challenging environment to find enough people to build these homes. So the backlog of new housing continues to grow. And I look at copper, and we've definitely broken an uptrend that's been intact since 2016. And, you know, your next support might be around 250 on the copper trade. So the message overall would suggest slower growth is what you would see with copper right now, Jim.
So, Craig, I know that you come from both a technical and a fundamental background. What would you say is the stronger of the two right now when it comes to, let's say, driving the market?
Well, interesting you say that, because here's my thought process on this. When I look at this market from a fundamental perspective and throw that hat on, you look at a market that's trading at about 18 times next year's numbers, and to justify a meaningfully higher price objective for this market from here, you've got to start to be thinking about a 19 or a 20 multiple on forward earnings. Earnings estimates have been revised up. They've been fairly strong. It implies that fundamentally you would be arguing for some sort of peak earnings and peak multiple applied to justify a higher target. I struggle with that a little bit. Now, from the technical world, I like to look at a lot of the intermarket relations. So I start thinking about what are the financials saying? What is Dow Theory saying that Ralph Acampora, who's been a frequent contributor to your show, has talked about? And you look at how these intermarket pieces are working, and you see some questionable things. Financials remain weak. That always makes me nervous. The industrials have rolled over, and you look at Boeing, and you look at Caterpillar, and you look at 3M. They're all breaking uptrends. Again, these are things that kind of raise a question mark in my mind from a technical perspective. The flattening of the yield curve from a technical perspective, looking at those charts. All these pieces, when you put it together, and the weakness, and I'm now starting to see in the transportation, airlines specifically, and some of the rails having started to violate uptrends or be relative laggards, leads me to have some real question marks. And again, 2850 is kind of the best number that I've come up with now. And I struggle technically or fundamentally, Jim, to really sign a much meaningfully higher target than where we're at.
You know, Craig, and I just want to point out, over the last 4 or 5 years, you've been one of the more bullish analysts that we've had on the program. In fact, a couple of years, I used to call you Bullseye Craig. You nailed it at the beginning of the year. Have you got to the point? I remember you telling me a story once when you were going down the halls, and I think this was ahead of 2007, and you were warning people, and they just kind of looked at you like you were crazy. Are you getting any of that kind of pushback when you look at this and you're taking that cautious view that you are now?
Oh, I would definitely say that the individual you're talking about was a very interesting individual by the name of Spike. He used to work on our trading desk, and Spike is unfortunately no longer working at Piper Jaffray, but I will tell you that what I'm getting is this more cautious tone. People look at me and they're like, Craig, what's wrong? You know, what's wrong with this market? Clearly, the economy is doing well. A lot of things are doing well. And therefore, how can you have a more cautious tone on this market? And from my perspective, I continue to come back and point out the issues. But yeah, I'm getting a little bit of pushback. So clearly, I'm not as much in consensus with a lot of people at this point in time. And probably that's a good thing. When I find that I'm in consensus, I'm more nervous about the fact that I might be wrong.
Well, I tell you, last time we had you on the program, you said the markets were going to struggle, and that's certainly been the case. Craig, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow your work, tell them how they could do so, please.
Feel free to email me at craig.w.johnson@pjc.com or reach out to your local Piper Jaffray salesperson. They certainly can help. Thank you.
Interest rates are rising, and the Fed intends to raise interest rates even further. As rates rise, the value of your bond funds will fall. Are you prepared for the next bond bear market? It has been almost 36 years since we've seen the last, and there's a high probability that another bear market in bonds has just begun. Long-term interest rates have been rising steadily since last fall. It's time to think about protecting capital. That's where Financial Sense Advisors can help you. Protect capital by designing a customized portfolio that can provide you with predictable income. Don't put your hard-earned wealth at risk. Call us today.
So give us a call at Financial Sense Advisors. As investment fiduciaries, we put your interest first. Let us help you design a portfolio that provides predictable income and protects your capital. Call now, toll free, 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939 to let us help you design a portfolio providing predictable income and protecting your capital. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities Incorporated, member FINRA, SIPC. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. In case you didn't know it, the Financial Sense NewsHour is more than just our weekend show. We also have a weekday program featuring key economic experts, which is only available to our premium members. Here's part of one of the interviews from this last week.
The primary trend in inflation is largely driven by what we see in the U.S. manufacturing sector. So if you look at what's called the ISM Manufacturing PMI, PMI standing for Purchasing Managers Index, that data gives about a two-year lead on inflation. And so we have a chart of that. You can see it. But essentially what it is saying is that we should expect to see inflation pick up for the next year to year and a half and not peak out until late 2019 or early 2020.
Well, on this Friday, we've got interest rates that have been hovering, but I guess the good news is they're lower than where they used to be. But it hasn't been good news for the government. A report coming out this week saying the budget deficit next year will be $1.1 trillion. A reason for part of that is rising interest rates in the U.S. Joining us on the program from Financial Sense Advisors is Rob Bernard. Rob, why don't you take us a quick view of rates around the globe? We can talk about where we are in the U.S., but, you know, when I take a look at where we are in the U.S., it almost looks like junk bonds when I look around the globe.
That's right, Jim. The U.S. 10-year is at 287. The U.K. comes in at 1.27. France, 0.67, Germany 0.37, Switzerland is a negative 0.102, Japan 0.25, 0.2%. Argentina comes in at the hot spot of 8.25 and Brazil 5.40. You can tell where the risk is in the yield curve of the world bond market.
Rob, you know, as we talk about those rates, why don't we share with our listeners the rates that really matter? I mean, right now, the U.S. is acting as a magnet to the rest of the globe. I mean, why would I want to put money in Switzerland at a negative 0.1% or 2 basis points in Japan or Germany, for that matter, where it's less than 0.4% when I can get almost 3% in the U.S.? So of those rates, besides the U.S., what other rates matter here?
Well, you got an idea that Argentina is sitting at 8.25, but you know, that's next to Venezuela or quickly approaching it. And Brazil has their own issues at a 540. So as you said, Jim, the U.S. is a magnet. And if you've got excess money to invest someplace around the world, you're going to put it here on our yield curve, on the Treasury yield curve, as opposed to anyplace else.
I want to move on and let's go back to the U.S. market. We've had Treasuries. It's hard to believe, Rob, that going back to last summer, we were almost at 1.25% on two-year treasuries, and now we're at almost 2.6%. Let's talk about some of the other markets that matter here in the U.S. Let's talk about municipal bonds, and especially when you have states like California that have income tax rate the highest in the country at 13.3%. What's going on in Muni World?
Muni World is, as you say, pretty exciting based on the states that have high tax rates. As I said before, the two-year maturities for municipals are somewhere between 1.75% and 2%. Now, that's pretty amazing considering the 10-years are 5% to yield anywhere from 3.30 to 370. And in some states, if you buy those bonds in your particular state, of your particular state, that is, that's double tax-free. So a 3.5% to 4% tax-free rate is equal to 8% in a normal corporate rate. So those rates are very attractive and they're well bid. Every week, sometimes we'll get five brand new offerings and they all are oversubscribed to the point where they actually lower the interest rate. They give you less because the demand is so high. So munis are still in huge demand based on taxes.
Rob, let me throw this. Did the new tax law that went into effect this year, where under the new federal tax law, you're limited to, let's say, $10,000 on property tax deductions, which, you know, in California is nothing. You can't deduct state taxes anymore. Has that created a further demand for municipal bonds? Do you think that's what's driving it?
Well, it's twofold. Even before they changed the tax situation with property tax and being able to deduct your state tax, high income earners have had issues deducting anyway, because as their income goes up, those deductions are worth less because they phase them out. So guys that are making $500,000, $600,000, $700,000, over $1 million a year, the California state exemption for your income tax really holds no water anyway. And your property tax starts to mean less and less because it doesn't work for them anymore. So based on this, the munis are very, very meaningful for these high net worth guys.
What about the fact that a lot of states are going to have to roll over a lot of their debt? Where would you say muni rates are today, now that we've been in this rising interest rate environment, to, let's say, what you were getting on munis, let's say, a year ago?
It really hasn't changed that much because of the demand. I mean, you'd think you'd get more. The only place really you're getting more is on the front end of the curve because of the fact of what the Federal Reserve is doing. I mean, look at the two-year treasury. It's at almost 2.6%. So if you can get almost 2% muni yield, or 1.75% muni yield, for two and a half years, that's a fantastic yield comparatively to other maturities out there, or quality or types of paper, I should say.
So we've got rising treasury yields. Municipals are well bid right now. Rob, if you're looking for interest rates, let's talk about junk bonds and emerging market debt rates, because as investors are scouring the globe for yield, the two places that are left are junk bonds and emerging market debt. But it seems to me there would be problems in both.
Well, let's talk about emerging markets for a moment. As the dollar continues to strengthen, as we continue to raise interest rates, it provides a huge headwind for emerging markets because most of that debt has been sold in dollar denominations. So therefore, when these emerging markets have to pay interest and principal back, they have to convert their own currency to US dollars in order to pay it back. Well, if their economies are starting to fall or weaken, that means their currency is going to start to weaken. That means they need more of their home currency to buy US dollars, which has in effect appreciated. So this is a huge problem for the emerging markets, especially now with a strong dollar.
So given the fact that the yield curve seems to be flattening now, we're down to 25, 30 basis points, and you figure there's, what, over 80% probability they'll be raising interest rates in September and high probability in December. Let's talk about the yield curve and what does that mean? And when you take a look at the bond markets, what are you doing for clients right now?
Well, traditionally and historically, a flattening of the yield curve usually means trouble ahead. In this particular case, does it really? I mean, are we in the eighth inning of our economic expansion? Ninth inning? Seventh inning? Where are we? But traditionally, when that inverts, meaning that the short end of the curve winds up yielding more than the long end of the curve, that usually portends an economic slowdown anywhere from 6 to 8 months down the road. This time, it could be different. And people will always say, uh-oh, when anybody says that, watch out. But if you think about it, the reason why the long end of our bonds are so well bid is what we talked about before, because our rate is the highest in the rest of the good neighborhood gang, you might say. And a lot of that money that's in Europe and different parts of Asia is being attracted to the United States. And so in effect, our 10-year bond is very well bid because of the fact of the demand, and our inflation seems to be well under control. Now, in my particular case, what I'm doing for my clients, to take advantage of the short end of the yield curve, I'm buying floating rate bonds for them. And these are bonds that float with LIBOR and a margin. And in some cases, we're getting anywhere between 5 and 6.15%. And this is the place to be because the risk is very low. The bonds are very liquid. When it comes time to exit these positions, we'll have plenty of liquidity to access.
And the way floating rate bonds, and we just might want to explain this for our listeners, they're kind of like adjustable rate mortgage. So every time the Fed raises interest rates, like they will be doing in September, these bonds adjust upward, just like an adjustable rate mortgage. However, somewhere down the line, Rob, you know, the Fed, instead of raising rates, will be lowering rates. Would you be getting out of floating rate bonds at that time? Because then they'll be traveling in the opposite direction. And when they do, what happens to their prices?
Well, that's the tricky part, is to try to time it before the Fed rates peak. Because you're right. If the Federal Reserve starts to roll over and lower rates, then you must exit those positions for obvious reasons, because you don't want to ride the rates back down again. You want to go into a fixed rate position and to lock your rate in for a declining interest rate environment. In this particular case, we are forecasting 2 rate hikes this year. And until further notice, we are still on board for at least 3 next year. And at that point, it's too tough to look at your crystal ball at that point to see where rates are going.
So given the fact that munis are at a strong bid, you've got short-term treasuries are looking good, floating rate corporate bonds, it seems like, is probably the best place to be, at least if you want to be in the corporate space. What about individual stocks? Traditionally, when you get into this kind of a period of uncertainty and weakness, as we're seeing globally, traditional type stocks, you know, tobacco stocks, real estate investment trust, consumer staples, utilities have done well. What are you seeing there, Rob?
I'm still not ready to have full conviction on the consumer staples sector. I'm still a big proponent of tech, of consumer discretionary, but right now I'm not a big proponent of the consumer staples. My adage is if you can eat it, drink it, smoke it, talk on it, switch it on or off, that's what you want to own in a declining economic environment. Currently, we're basically in maybe the 8th inning, maybe the 7th inning, who knows, maybe the 9th inning, as I said before. That's late cycle, cyclicals, tech, industrials, even though you wouldn't recognize it now because of the pressure from the trade wars that we're kind of duking it out with. But nonetheless, late cycles can be extended. And I think that the tax cuts extended the United States late cycle. And who knows when it's going to start winding down.
Well, I know at least for 2019, you're going to have almost $500 trillion of stimulus that will still kick in. Rob, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow your work or get in touch with you, tell them how they could do so, please.
Sure, Jim. They can contact me via email, rob.bernard@financialsense.com. Or they can call in at 888-486-3939 and just ask for Rob Bernard.
Well, what would happen if somebody gave a Fed chair testimony and no one came? Actually, though, the Fed spoke, but no one seemed to notice because the media were totally obsessed with the Trump-Putin summit. And usually when the Fed chair speaks, everybody listens because the markets are concerned and the people are concerned and those people who have jobs are concerned. So what exactly did they say and why should we be concerned? All of that coming up next as we look at that and the rising war between President Trump and the Federal Reserve, looking toward the elections of 2020, as the Financial Sense News Hour continues at financialsense.com.
The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertised with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.